Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 18 with Dr. Guy Hodgson. Originally from South Africa, Guy now lives in Texas, where he and his family own and run Royal Sea Stud. Guy is a breeder, but also rides many of his own homebred horses. We first met in Geneva in 2016, and in our few conversations since then, I've always found him to be a very interesting individual, very insightful, and has a very good way of articulating his points and views on breeding and horses in general. Just before we go on to talking about the breeding program, I wanted to get a bit more of a background, because you were born in South Africa, but I'm wondering what sequence of events led you to the US and then led you on to setting up your farm in Texas?
South Africa in the 70s and 80s, you were forced into the military. So I was one of those people that was sent into the military for a year. And then when I was in there, it was extended to a second year. Problem that I had with being in the military there, and I was very opposed to it, is I was being asked to pick up a gun and go and fight against people that were effectively doing what I would do if I were in their circumstance. Remember, the black people there were horribly discriminated against by the nationalist party, the ruling Afrikaner government in South Africa. And so as a young white guy there, you were forced into military or 5 years in jail. So I spent the time in the military. It was really rough. And then I came out and I studied. When I finished studying, then they called me back again and said, you're going back to the military for 3 months. And at that point, I said, oh, no chance, and left to America. Now, I knew that was a high probability that they were going to call me back again. So I'd already prepared, and I'd been the top graduating student in South Africa. So I applied to optometry school at the University of Houston and got accepted. And so I came to America and studied 2 years to convert. I had to convert a Bachelor of Science degree and complete the American doctorate in optometry. And then I did a residency at the Lighthouse for the Blind, specializing in blindness. It was always with the thought that I would go back to South Africa, but I think once I'd done my residency, it was quite an unusual one. A surgeon in Houston got hold of me and asked if I would work with him. So I did that for 2 years and then went into private practice, and suddenly I ended up staying in America.
And before you actually moved to the US, had you an interest in horses already, or did that come later?
Oh, no, I'd been obsessed with horses before I could walk. My parents said it was the oddest thing they'd ever seen. This tiny kid, he couldn't even talk. If we saw a horse and cart going down the road, I would just go mad. I would stand at the window and have to be taken out there, and we'd just stand and stare at these horses. And then at weekends, I would want to take me on a drive to go and see these two horses called Gypsy and Hunter, who were 5 miles away in a field. And they said I would just stand at the field looking at them. No, it was instinctive. I can't ever think over time where I didn't have this. First thing I think about in the morning and last thing I think about at night is horses.
And is it a coincidence that one of your triplet sons is called Hunter?
That's an interesting question. I never thought he came from that, but quite possibly in the back of my mind, it may be Gypsy Hunter. Yeah, it's true. That's funny. That is true. Yeah. Very observant of you, Michael.
I suppose your move to the US, I didn't know any of that, and it was quite an interesting move. But also your move into your breeding program as well was quite an unusual one. It's not really how most people come about breeding horses. And for those that don't know you, would you mind kind of going into that process? How you ended up kind of delving into the breeding world, or what drew you to it?
Sure. So, I'd ridden as a child in South Africa, then I came to America, then I'd been studying. But as soon as I finished studying and was then working, I got a horse, and started to write again. And so in the mid 1990s, I got really obsessed with what made a good horse, what made a very good horse, and what made an exceptional horse. What were the characteristics between a horse that could jump in the Olympics and one that was, say, a good meter 30 horse? And so I spent a lot of time studying this and would go to shows and stand in the warm-ups and go to the ring and just watch and watch and watch. And I came up with the characteristics that I thought were very important in a top show jumper. And then thought to myself, okay, well, you know, everybody can see it when a horse is at the top of the sport, but how do you find that before it's been found? So I stepped, you know, sort of backwards. So I started to look at young horses. And ultimately with that, started to go to the two-year-old stallion approvals. So I found that that was a good place to start, because now you were looking, I understand some of the horses are being prepared and so on, but really and truly, when you're taking a body of 70 or 80 horses like that, you can see the spectrum and you can find the two or three that are exceptional there. And then from that, I thought, okay, how do you find that as a foal? So I would go off and look at lots of foals. Thousands of foals would be walking around in the fields in Holstein, and all the foal evaluations, all in Holstein. And then we'd go to the breeders and walk around their farms. And then that was the start where I thought, this breeding is fascinating to me. Because now I was looking at these mares and foals, I would know the stallions. And I thought that was something that I wanted to do. And then had to go and find the right mare.
Why Germany and why Holstein initially?
I liked Holsteiners. They're very good looking, rideable, well-built, good jumping animals. And I just find a Holstein a very attractive animal. And at that time, I had bought a Holsteiner stallion. And so, it just ended up that way. I'm not sure it was by as much design as I just liked everything, and everything fell into place. And once it was in place, I thought, I'm going to focus on one breed. I saw no reason to not, because Holsteiners looked like the pinnacle of it to me. What I mean by that, and I know this might upset some sort of Westphalian and Oldenburg breeders, but I really see that those breeds have been strengthened by the Holsteiner blood. I mean, you go and you can look through their pedigrees and you can see, wow. So I was looking at like this, and I think also the mother lines in Holstein. You know, there's no mother lines tracked like in Holstein. They've done a brilliant job with that. And that became fundamental in my desire to study and understand breeding.
And even with your initial study on the biomechanics, as you put it previously, of horses and trying to identify those traits, then trying to identify them foals. What was the conclusion of your research? What were those essential ingredients that you felt, we'll say for simplicity, all good horses needed to have as a foundation, or at least most of them?
Now, I've been asked that many times. And I think always end up with somewhat of a similar answer. It's like looking at a very good painting. And you're told that's a great painting and you can see it. Yet how do you describe that? Because it's a thousand things that you're seeing. And so, I mean, we all know the horse has got to have good balance. The horse has got to have good structure. It's got to have a good hind end. But, you know, I know what it looks like. I find it very difficult to describe. I'm not sure that I could lay it out. You know, we can all lay out the things, but when people will show me horses or five horses, and I say, that's a good one. And they'll start to say, why? It just looks different to me. This doesn't look the same. And I found that when I've met people that I really respect, that I think are very good at evaluating young horses, they're kind of the same as well. They can't fully tell you why they pick that one, but they There's just something about it that it has.
Yeah, and I found with some friends even that I would consider exceptional at picking a good horse, that it's almost this instinctual feeling, which is very hard when you're trying to then package something from an educational perspective and, you know, and share that with others, because it's very hard to impart that instinctual feeling.
Yeah, what I've done with people that have really wanted to learn, I've had them come, say, to the Holstein approvals with me and sit there, tell them you're going to sit here for 8 or 10 hours, you look at a lot of horses, yeah, a lot of work, write down your thoughts on every horse. And then they said, next thing, we discuss each one. And then it's right in front of you, because they'll say things, and I say, yes, but have you looked at this? Or, wow, that one really jumps. Well, yeah, but it's going to be too big. Or that horse, yeah, it looks like it has scope, but it doesn't. You know, there's just certain characteristics that the whole package has to fit together. And I think it's just something visual in front of you. I think one thing I've also, Michael, that I've learned over the time, and certainly has developed, that there's not one perfect horse. Mm-hmm. That you can have all types that can be very, very successful and excellent, and vastly different. And again, also can be have different uses. What you're going to jump the big class at Spruce Meadows may be a different horse than what you're going to try and win a speed class on it in Wellington.
And what was your motivation initially for that level of kind of in-depth analysis or research? What was your maybe initial goal with it or end goal with it? Was it from a commercial perspective to find these talents, produce them and sell them? Or was it primarily just kind of a fascinating research project to you?
Oh yeah, a fascinating research project. And I also found that it was very difficult to go to someone and get them to give me the answer. So I kind of figured if I really wanted to know it, you know, I needed to do it myself. Of course, taking information from people along the way, mm-hmm. Getting their opinions. But there wasn't a place that I could go to and you could just watch this video and you could miraculously tell what was a good horse. No, yeah. This you can't. And I also found that people that may be very good riders, I would listen to what they thought was a good horse and I would think, no. Mm-mm. No, sometimes the good horse the ideas of it came from people that you would least expect. They may not be riders. They, you know, be somebody who's breeding or somebody who's helping get horses ready for stallion approvals. And you speak to them and you think, wow, they just have a way of seeing it or describing it. I thought, I spoke to thousands of people, I'm sure. And the shows, warm-ups, everywhere. Yeah.
But also, I think from my few conversations with you over the years, I think your retention and your analysis, I think, is quite good and thorough. Like, you know, a lot of us consume a lot of information, but probably forget as much as we hear, as we remember. But I think you're... Maybe it's the level or it's the depth that you go into when there's a topic that interests you, but you seem to analyze things very well, retain that information very well, and my experiences then articulate that quite well.
Thank you. You know, it's not a day that goes by that I don't look at some horse videos, that I'm not studying it in some capacity. Even this morning, I was watching... a jump off of Ben Mayer riding
Tic Tac.
Yeah. Okay. 19-year-old stallion. I thought, I just want to look at this stallion. And then, of course, I pulled up his breeding to see, you know, he's got Heartbreaker in the third line. And
yeah,
so he's got Parker, Heartbreaker. And I didn't know that. And then I watched the round a number of times to see. And obviously, you can see, and it's demonstrated over the ox, especially when Ben gets ever so slightly long in the jump off there, how beautifully the horse just releases its hind end. And that's very much a Darko characteristic.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I just love. Then I'll just quietly sit by myself and won't say anything to anybody. It just gets put into my mind and I'll then be led off to look at something else.
Yeah, a fascinating puzzle. Then going back to your initial research in Holstein, then will you talk us through how you came about finding your foundation broodmare?
Okay. Well, I'd been to the Holstein approvals with my wife, and we were looking for a horse for her, and we found an absolutely superb young grey, 4-year-old. The guy was looking for horses for me there. We were going to be there for 10 days. We arrived, and I said to him, "Well, do you have any horses for me to look at?" He said, "Yes, I have one." I said to him, "What do you mean, one?" So he said, no, you're so picky. I'm not going to send you around looking at 5-10 different horses. No. There's one horse. This is the right horse." And he was absolutely correct. We got there, and the horse was superb. And it free jumped beautifully. It was superb to ride. Unfortunately, it didn't pass the vet. And despite me trying to make every excuse that I could to get it past the vet, both the vet in Germany and here in America said the horse will have arthritis at some point. And it's 1 foot, can't tell you when it's going to be, but it will. So we left that horse. And while I'd been at the approval, somebody had seen me there and come up and given me a booklet. I didn't know who they were. They were a breeder from East Germany. So when I got back home, I was just looking through all my paperwork and saw this booklet of the horses they had for sale and got hold of them. Well, lo and behold, they didn't speak a word of English. So they got an interpreter for me. And through her, I asked them, could they send me videos? So they sent me 4 videos. And I sat down at my computer. The first one was okay. Second one was okay. The third one, I jumped out of my skin. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And the fourth one, I could hardly get to the fourth one after the third. And so it was Christmas Day. I said to my wife, "I'm going to Germany today. That's it." "We're at her parents' house. You got to be kidding me." I said, no, I've seen this horse. No, this is a rare talent. I've got to go. So I went down to the airport, got on the plane, flew to East Berlin, arrived there in Berlin. The people picked me up in a car. I remember it was this old car. I was in the back seat. I thought I was going to be fumigated driving to their farm. It had no damn heater in it. And I thought, if something happens to me, nobody's going to even know where the heck I am. I'm where the Iron Curtain used to be. So we got there for the day, and they were lovely, and they had the interpreter there, and it brought the horses out and looked at them. And eventually this was this stallion that I'd seen, who was 4, or just coming 4, brought him out, free jumped in. It was fantastic. And I liked him, and they showed me all the other horses. And then we went and had a cup of coffee, as you always do when you're over there. And then the breeder said to me, "Okay, you're obsessed with horses. So what we're going to do is going to bring all the horses in from our field, and we're just going to free jump them all." So there we go. It's now 6 o'clock at night. So we're going along, we're free jumping all these young horses. And probably about 9 o'clock at night, or 10 o'clock at night, here comes this 2-year-old mare. And I couldn't believe it. That was the mare that I was looking for. And I absolutely knew it when I saw her go over the first X. She had every characteristic that I wanted in a broodmare. And so I acted very cool. But, you know, we sat down later, I went to her, I said, "Well, I'm interested in buying that mare." And they said, "Well, no, she's not for sale. She's obviously the future of our breeding program, but we really respect you that you can see, you know, that she's good." So I came back and, you know, I had her on my mind. And we left a few days later, Kim and myself, to fly to South Africa to go on safari. And Kim loves to remind me that every day on the safari, I've spent 3 or 4 hours watching the video of this mare jumping forwards and backwards, stopping it, calling her over. "Come look at this. You've got to see this," I would tell her. So I just had to have that mare. So I got back, and then I flew back to Germany after I got back from South Africa and to now negotiate the other horse for my wife, but they still wouldn't sell me the mare. So okay, so we flew back. And then on Valentine's Day, I decided, no, I'm going back to Germany. So I flew back there and then made a deal with them with 3 horses. Unfortunately, the breeder had been diagnosed with cancer in that time period. And he said to me, "Look, I'll sell you this mare as long as you will respect the breeding program as I have for so many years. You know, I can see you're crazy about horses, and I want you to have her. So that's how I ended up with her. And I ended up with that one that had originally got me on the plane in the first place. And he ended up being an amazing horse. I jumped many Grand Prix with him, many high AO classics I won. It was an amazing horse, and he's still now 22 years old and still competing. He's now doing low hunters, and not with me, somebody else is riding a fantastic horse.
And then 20 years later, that contender mare is still it's still what you focus on in your breeding program.
That's correct. Yep, I've got. So what I learned very, very early on from the many breeders that I spoke to and walked around in muddy fields with them in Holstein, or had coffee with them, mare approvals, foal approvals, and so on, was don't breed a mare if she's not good enough. And if you want to be successful in breeding, it's going to be about the mare. The mare is going to bring you more than the stallion is.
Yeah.
That it's absolutely essential. So I had this mare out of a good mother line in 1916. Two of her brothers had gone on to jump internationally. One was Marco Kutcher, the horse contour, was the full brother. Mm-hmm. And Lassegat Contour was ridden by Eric Neve and Stanley Van Passion, also a top international horse. And the cousin, so my mare's mother, and the mother to Kurt, is ridden by Piet Reimakers, that jumped in the World Equestrian Game and the gold team for Netherlands, is the cousin. But these happened after I bought my mare. This happened. I could just, you know, I knew she was a good mother line, but I liked mother line 1916 at that time, so I researched it further. Small one, but a successful one. But that part has turned out to be a very, very good producing part of the mother line. Yeah.
And often with a lot of breeders, myself included, I think this was a point we might have touched on briefly in a previous conversation, but often with breeders, maybe more so now than in the past, we like to have, you know, maybe two different lines or three different lines and a bit of variety. What's your thought process around solely focusing and kind of doubling down on just the one? Because I'm sure there have been ample opportunities to take on another line over the past 20 years.
There have been. You know, at the time when I started to breed, embryo transfer was available, but it was fairly new. And at that point, I just thought to myself, I so believe in this mare. This is what I want to focus on. And let me do it via embryo transfer. Much to the chagrin of many people who I've subsequently reminded in Germany, because they thought, oh, it's not going to work. And if the original mother doesn't bring them up, and all this sort of stuff, fine. They're all doing it now themselves. Yeah. And it appears that they're having good success. But, you know, it was fairly new technology in those days. And I just thought, I've got this mare, this is what I have to do. And so when I was offered other mares, people, this is the way I'm going to do it. And that's all I've done. I've only bred on her. And now I have a very, very good daughter by Cardenta that I'm expecting a foal from this year. So from the original contender mare, who's now getting old, I think she's 21 this year, 22. So I'm going to have to use a daughter.
But your faith in the line appears to have, watching from afar anyway, appears to have paid dividends. You've had some great days with horses. That family.
Yeah, amazing, amazing horses. I won't say lucky, because I don't know if all this amount of study results just in luck. I mean, I would say good fortune. Yeah. But I have fortunately bred some very, very nice and athletic jumpers. And the only horses I'm riding at the moment are ones from my breeding program. And the reason that's happened, because I've had a bunch of other ones that I've ended up selling, is because the best ones, in my opinion, and I'm up in the saddle, so that's where the decisions being made from, the ones that I like riding the most have been the ones that have come from my breeding program. And I have three very good ones that I leave for Florida next week with.
How do you think you're in the fortunate position that you can ride what you breed. How do you think that influences what you breed? And if you didn't ride, do you ever think about how your breeding program would be different or the choices that you would make if you weren't the one that was going to be riding those horses?
I'll answer this in a roundabout way, but I think it's a very crucial point for certainly, because many breeders will know, but any would-be breeder as well, is that it's essential that you focus on rideability as well when you're breeding. And this came about, I was with Dirk Allman in Holstein many years ago, and we were at his place, and I was looking around, and all the young horses were showing me, they were all by the stallion Clinton, not the Clinton from Dirk de Meersman, but the Carolus Clinton who was in Holstein. I said, well, why are they all by Clinton? And he said, oh, no, you need to learn something early on as a breeder. If you don't breed a rideable horse, you're going to own it for a long time. And he said, one thing about Clinton, they're all extremely rideable, and sometimes I get a very good jumper. And he said, that works for me. And wow, I thought, Okay, and I went home, and I've never forgotten that. And so as a rider, rideability. When they're not rideable, you've got long days ahead of you and you can't sell them. So much work you have to do before you can sell them.
Yeah, I was just thinking in advance of our talk, I was just thinking about that as breeders, we can kind of just go for broke, and it's just, you're just looking maybe at the performance that those horses have achieved or their offspring have achieved. But I was actually thinking in your situation, when you're having to ride them all, how much, you would focus on trainability, mentality, rideability, all those interlinked characteristics, because there's obviously it's sensible for their future if they leave you as well, but also from a self-preservation perspective, you know, you don't want to be bringing trouble upon yourself.
You know, you speak to some breed and say, oh, well, we're just trying to, you know, we're going to breed me to 60 horses. I think, well, yeah, that's easy to say. But a horse to get to a meter 60 is not only its ability to jump, but the whole program is going to have to be right. And then you're going to have the correct jockey on this and the development and the costs. So the reality is most horses don't go on to jump a meter 60, and that's okay. You can have many, many good horses that are useful jumping a meter 40, meter 50. To 45, they're still very useful horses. But when you look at that market, who's going to ride them? You know, you've got this huge amateur market, certainly here in America, that's riding a lot of these horses. And these people are not riding 5-6 days a week, sometimes only riding a couple of days a week. So if you get this horse that's, you know, I mean, difficult to ride, okay, well, that's not going to work, you know. And then if it can jump a meter 60, you're going to have a real specialist up there who can actually ride it. And you and I can name probably 5 of them in the world that can actually handle those complete lunatics and get it around. They're incredible horses, but they're not for everybody. So I think rideability, listen, a rideable horse can still be a very good jumper.
And yeah, they're not mutually exclusive.
There can't be a jump. It's a jump. Yeah.
How would you define your own breeding goal in your own program? What's the overarching thing that you're trying to achieve?
A rideable, well-conformed, naturally sound, athletic jumper. Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. I'm not sure if I sit down so much and define those things, because as I was saying it though, I was just thinking them. Have I ever really thought about them that? Because the way that I tend to breed, when people ask me, I always just put my hand up, and it's like this, it's just a feeling. So I can't tell you what stallion I'm going to use till I decide, okay, now I'm going to think about it. And then I just suddenly feel it, like with Cardento. You know, I mean, I see all these horses on the circuit, whether I'm here in Europe or mm-hmm. wherever, and I had seen him jump. I think the first time I'd seen him in person was jumping at Hickstead. I liked him. I'd seen him jump some other time. So then I jumped on the plane and went to VDL Stud. And I said, okay. So they let him out the stables, gave me the rope, and said, well, why don't you just hold him here and let him eat some grass? So I'm standing there with him, looking at him, and I was thinking, you know, he's far from perfectly conformed. Okay, at short pastens, he was not a particularly good-looking horse. He was quite angular. And he was absolutely the right horse for my mare. But I just knew I have to use Cardento. Okay? And so I used him. And I'm absolutely thrilled. Thrilled. Two of them will go to Florida with me this year.
I was just going to touch on those two, because last year you went to Florida with, I don't know, was them or was it in Tryon? The two full siblings, was it in Tryon where one became, was it the OA champion and one became the reserve champion at the...
Both those horses won a number of championships, but the one, Cardento Captain, I took him there, and it's a 5-week circuit this last fall in Tryon, and he jumped in the AO section, AO division, and there were 139 horses in, they combined the whole lot, and he ended up number one. And he only did 3 of the 5 weeks, but he won so many, was he the first or second? I mean, he's amazing. When I go in the thing is, when I go in the ring with him, I know that I can win. That doesn't mean that I will win, but I know that if all the stars align correctly, I have a horse under me that I can win with. And that is a lovely feeling. Yeah. Because every single rider that listens to this will know they've sat at an in-gate and they're thinking to themselves, man, I'll be lucky if I can get on the podium with this one. Okay. But it's a fantastic feeling when you think to yourself, I can do it, right? If it's a good day, I can get there. And that's how I feel every time I go in with him if I pick his class ride. He's careful. He's cat-like, like a little rubber ball, and he loves it. And he's the spookiest horse I've ever ridden. He's so spooky. Nearly fall off every time in the warm-up.
And you're leaving next week for Wellington again with your homebreds. What's your main motivation for going to Wellington? And actually, maybe we'll even take a step back. For those that have never been to Wellington, I think it's quite an experience, even as a spectator, the whole thing. How would you best describe that, first of all? And then what's your motivation for going there with your homebreds?
First I'm going to go to the new facility, the World Equestrian Center in Ocala, for 3 weeks.
Okay.
I'm going to do that, and then I'll go on for 5 or 6 weeks to Wellington. Motivation to go to Wellington is because Wellington is, in essence, America's Aachen. It's the pinnacle of American horse show, except Aachen goes on for a week. This goes on for 12 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. I think you've got 4,000 horses there. Anybody who's been there has seen just the houses and the farms, and the level of rider and horse is absolutely remarkable. And I like to go to Wellington because the best of the best from America are there. And also they have a division called the Masters Division. It's for those over 50. And
that's what you won last year, was it?
Yeah, I mean, I've won it many times. I won 4 out of 6 weeks of it. It's hard. It's hard to win once because it's known as the fastest division there. And I watched a video from last weekend. I mean, they were going so fast. I was thinking, oh, geez, I don't know. Am I up to it again this year? But it's incredible fun because the people arrive on amazing horsepower, and they can ride. And they go as fast. You can never go. I never go faster in the year than I go there. I mean, I'm sometimes hanging on thinking, this is mad.
But that must be incredible. No more than that feeling at the in-gate when you know you can win. There's few places in the world where people have the level of resources that they do in Wellington or those competing in Wellington. And as you said, the horsepower, even if you watch, even if you watch the lower classes, you're watching the horses. They're phenomenal. They're often more impressive than those that are in the professional classes. And for you then to rock up, drive over from Texas and rock up with your homebred horses and say last year, for example, win, was it 4 out of the 6 master's classes? There must be a lot of satisfaction in that as a breeder, as a rider, for your production system. It has to be a good feeling.
It is. I mean, it's in America, it's very rare to have a rider have bred their own horse. I mean, there are a few of us, but there's a handful. And to have, you know, bred the horse, delivered it, started it, got it going, and then have it in the ring and then be able to win. It's an amazing feeling. And I've shared with you this interesting story because I think this is so germane to the way that I think about it. I was walking down one of the pathways 3 or 4 years ago, and one of the main ring announcers put up his hand. I was actually on my bicycle stop. I thought, okay, I probably did something wrong in the ring, and he's going to give, you know, tell me. And he stopped and said, hello. And he said, well, I just want to tell you something. I said, okay. And he said, I want to tell you, every time you come in the ring, I tell the judges and the other announcers and people in the box up there with me, watch this guy. He has the happiest horses here at the horse show. And I just wanted you to know that. I said, wow, thank you. And I said, you know, it's funny you say that, because the first thing I say to my groom every single morning when I go down to the horses is, are they happy? I mean, that's what I really focus on. And so that's going back to what you were saying about the satisfaction of riding them. You know, they're like kids to me. I mean, I'm obsessed with horses. So I'm in there. If you had a microphone on me when I'm going around, you'd be laughing your head off, because I'm talking to them the whole time. Like, ask, what, why are you tapping that? Or I don't know. I'm just, you know, if they touched a jump or whatever's going on, it's because they've known me from them before they were out of their mother's body. I've had hold of their legs. I mean, as soon as they're out, I'm holding their head in my lap. Yeah. So they don't know anything different. I'm on their head. I'm stroking their ears. I'm scratching them. I'm talking to them. They've never not known that. And so it's, you know, as I say to people, I don't care if I never competed again. While I like to compete, that's not why I do this. I do this because I love horses. I just, that feeling when I'm in their presence is, I don't think of anything else. Just happy to be with them.
You mentioned if the microphone was on you, and it's something I wanted to ask you about, because when the microphone was on you last year at WEF, can you explain how somebody born in South Africa, living in Texas, ends up at Wellington performing the national anthem with the Irish Chef to keep?
Okay, so Michael Blake and myself are great friends. He and I have been friends for quite some time. And, you know, Michael is a very good singer, very accomplished singer, sung in front of the Pope. Anyway, he was asked to sing the national anthem. So instead of going off and singing the national anthem, he decided to rope me in on this gig. He said to me, well, will you just play the guitar for me? I said, oh, I don't even know the national anthem. Okay, so I took out my guitar and tried to figure out the chords, but it's got a really strange timing, the national anthem, and the chords just didn't sound right. So I decided I needed to sit down and work out the individual notes. And so went and listened to Jimi Hendrix playing it and put that together. I don't know, 146 different notes or something. And sat there for 2 or 3 days practicing the national anthem and sending versions to Michael. And he had to practice singing along with it. And that was it. So, I mean, when I was up there, I was in disbelief. How in the world am I playing the guitar, playing, you know, Jimi Hendrix lead version of the guitar to the national anthem before the Nations Cup was Michael Blake? Anyway, how fun was that?
I just thought it was crazy. When I saw the picture last year at the time, I was like, it's such a strange sequence of events have obviously led to this, you know, led to this situation. Yeah, While competing at the likes of Wellington or Tryon, or you've traveled around, the first place that we met was Geneva in 2016. So you've, as a rider, as a breeder, as a spectator, you're exposed to a lot of obviously incredible horses. But is there one stallion that you have seen in the flesh that you think is particularly interesting, but you just haven't gotten the opportunity to use them and you would really love to?
Wow. You know, I mean, I see a lot of good stallions, but I understand your question, but to the way that I think, that is kind of like backwards. What mm-hmm. I'm meaning by that is I always look at the mare. That becomes the starting point. And then what is the stallion that seems to feel like is the right match?
Compliments.
Compliments to that mare. So while I look at stallions and I see I like them, I don't just think, oh, well, I want to breed to them, because it has to come the other way. It always has to come from what I'm being told from my feeling about the mare. Because I wouldn't use the stallion if it didn't seem right for the mare. That's not the way that I would go about breeding, because then I wouldn't feel it. It would seem back to front to me.
And I guess if you're only in a year, if you're only breeding, say, one mare or two mares as well, it's not like you're starting off with 20 mares and you think, oh, that's a really interesting one for this one, and this one.
Well, yeah, that's correct. Now, what I will do, Michael, is that I will see, so like you're looking at Tic Tac this morning. So I would put that in my head. And I don't know if his semen is available, if he even breeds here, but it would be in my mind. Then if I suddenly saw a mare and somebody was saying, well, I want to breed this mare, and that instinctively seemed like the right match, and then I would look at it on paper as well, you know, that's when I would say about the stallion.
I think there's a small bit in Belgium now, but I don't think it's publicly available, but it exists because I think some was taken before. In about 2012, he won the Belgian Championships with Jerome Gory. And I think there was some frozen, say, at some point leading up to that taken. So it exists, but I'm not sure.
Well, it's here in the United States. Talking about that, in saying that, it did come to mind. One stallion I find fascinating is Cartello.
I was one. That's that was my curiosity. I was wondering.
Obviously, I like his bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw him jumping a lot, and then I watched Lorcan on him a lot when Lorcan mm-hmm. had him, and you know, good friends with Lorcan, so I spoke to him about the stallion. And he was obviously very complimentary about the horse. I think he went superbly for him. And then now Dara riding him. I mean, the horse is amazing, but obviously it's interesting because we've got Cardento's mother there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. But I look at so many stallions all the time. I like stallions. I like stallions a lot. I've had some myself. But it's only just to put it into my memory bank so that I can pull it out when it seems right. And so if you ask me who would I be breeding to this year, to my mares, I don't know yet. I don't know yet. You know, just wait till it feels right.
How would you assess, I know this is, you're talking a massive area, but overall, how would you assess the kind of the breeding culture in the US at the moment? What are you seeing? What are the positives that you're seeing, and what are the areas that you feel have a long way to go?
You know, the breeding in the US is so spread out
mm-hmm.
and somewhat disjointed. And so it's I would say near impossible to get a global view of breeding in the US, because just, you know, if you're in Holstein, you can get a global view of breeding in Holstein. It's an accessible area.
Yeah.
and you can go around to the different regions. But then obviously if you come to the med performance tests and you know, the simulation of the best mares or the foal championships or stallion pools, you know, you're getting to see the best of the all the areas combined. And in the US, that's just not really possible. So it's kind of the same now as it was over the last 20 years. Yeah, people come and go in breeding. I would say there are some that continually breed. So I won't say that there aren't breeders like that here, but there's not a lot of them. A lot of the breeding also in America is one-off. And you've got a mare and they decide, oh, I'm going to breed this mare. And then off they go and breed it.
And that's true.
It's very difficult to track whatever happened to it, the offspring as well sometimes. Not an easy tracking system.
And culturally, are there any simple ways that you look at to improve it? Because as someone who's so into bloodlines and that, I'm sure you'd share my frustrations on this. The first time I went to Wellington, I remember I would have gone around to, I can't remember how many different rings there are in Wellington, but I went around to quite a lot of them. I watched quite a lot of classes from the top, the 500,000 Grand Prix down to the lower levels. To my knowledge, I never heard a commentator say what a horse was by. Occasionally, very occasionally, if they got really stuck for something to say, maybe they'd mention what country the horse was from, but it would be a real rarity. Whereas the first thing that as a breeder, a nice horse goes into the ring, you want to know what's it by, what's the pedigree, what's the mother line.
Sure, absolutely.
And I'm wondering, are there simple things that could be done to improve the culture to, I suppose, to get the equestrian industry in the US to care more about how horses are bred and where horses are bred?
I mean, I've thought about that long and hard, having been on the board of directors of the American Holstein Association, mm-hmm. 18 years or so. I've thought of that a lot. What I think I ultimately came to realize, Michael, is that the top level riders know the breeding for the most part. So you can go talk to them and they will not only be able to tell you the two sires right away, the sire and the dam sire, to the horse that they're riding. They can probably tell you that and probably tell you what stud book it's out of. But at the lower level riders, a lot will have no clue. And so in trying to think, well, how would I fix that? I realized it was a very difficult problem because here's where the issue comes in. If the horse is, say, Caratino Cassini 1, well, I know Caratino having stood in his stall many times and know Cassini 1, knowing him from his sports career and stood in his stall many times. To them, it's just a name because most of them haven't been, if you think about it, I mean, mm-hmm. most of these riders haven't been stomping around in the fields in Holstein or going to the Vavan and looking in the stallions. So, trying to get them really interested, it's relative, you know, it's relative to nothing because they just don't have that background knowledge for it really to mean something. So you do find some people that are very interested that haven't been there, that found videos and so on, and they're interesting to talk to, but a lot of others, it's meaningless to them. And that's unfortunate. It's like you don't even know what car you drive. But okay.
Yeah, because it's true. And this isn't something that I really thought about in this way in connection to the US. But I find Ireland is an incredible country for horse people and their history in horses. But because we're that bit far removed from the main kind of melting pot of like Holland, Belgium, Germany, the information and the speed of progress is that bit slower, which is sometimes frustrating here. Whereas your average breeder, your part-time breeder that you will bump into at an event in wherever, Holland, Belgium, Germany, always feels far more informed than their equivalent in
sure.
maybe in Ireland. but I suppose I never really thought about it then. It's almost like that problem of being somewhat removed from where the action's happening, multiplied by 1,000, because at the geographical barriers of accessing that.
Well, I think if you look at the ring, supposing there are 40 horses in the ring, maybe one or two maybe have been bred in the US, but most are coming out of Europe. So I don't know if you have a dog, Michael. Do you have a dog?
Two, yeah.
Okay. On the first one, can you tell me the sire to your dog's name and the sire to his mother?
Well, yes. Oh, sorry, okay. I can on the second. The first one we got as a puppy, and then he decided to visit the girl next door, and that resulted in us getting our pup from that litter. So I know the parents very well.
Okay, no good. But I was just thinking, like, we've got a dog, and I would have no idea who the parents are. And I think that's sort of what happens with a lot of people here. Unfortunately, because there's not a big breeding community here, while there are isolated people like myself that breed here and obviously know others, the vast majority in the horse show world here are not breeders and are not involved in breeding. And so the upper level riders, because they're riding a sports car here and they hear it so often, the bloodlines, they get into it a lot more. And they also like to look for certain characteristics in certain horses that they know. I don't know how you improve it yet. It's a difficult one to improve, and maybe it's not improvable. It just might be what it is. But I do agree with you, there should be mentioning, certainly in the upper level classes, the first two sires' name. Here in America, and I've spoken to them, I mean, they list the father, the sire, and then the mare. And I've gone to the office and said, with all due respect, I mean, this isn't political correctness, but why are we putting a mare down? She might have 10 foals in her life. Only, as breeders would even know the mare's name, and most we won't even know, okay? But put the first two sires, because they have many, thousands of offspring. So we're looking at combinations and so on. That's why breeders do it that way. And then if you want to go and find out the mare, you can.
Yeah.
But just putting the name down there, you're missing an opportunity to put down the correct way.
And you mentioned your involvement with the Holstein Verband in North America. Am I right in saying you're currently the vice chair, is it?
No, what's happened in America is it's got amalgamated into the German Holstein of a band.
Okay.
So a couple of years back, the American Holstein Association was closed, and the membership was rolled into the Holstein of a band. What I mean by that is, the way that the German Holstein of a band has handled this is to say any horse that could effectively have been bred in Germany by meeting their rules is eligible for German papers.
And is this the Holstein Global thing, or is this something else?
Holstein Global thing. Well, it's split up because it's really split into two pieces. If a horse, so I breed Berlin to my contender mare.
Mm-hmm.
That horse could have been born in Holstein.
Yes.
That horse then is eligible for full German papers. So I get full German papers on that, issued out of Kiel. Okay. If we have a mare here that doesn't qualify as a German Holsteiner mare, but she's good enough to breed on the Holstein books, that goes through the global system. That's the best way for me to explain to it.
And when you say she's... When you say she's good enough, is that in terms of her prize money or what she's done?
Well, it could be prize money. No, she'd be evaluated, go to a mare evaluation. She'd have to go to a mare site and be looked at. She gets bonneted. That's the scoring of her physical characteristics and her walk, trot, and canter. And then she would have to have what would be considered an acceptable pedigree. So, if you're bringing a mare, say, by Cardento, but out of a Dutch mother line going back. You know, now already she's got at least 50% in Holstein.
Yeah.
And if she's physically correct enough and bred to a approved Holstein stallion, she can produce papers that would be issued under the global.
And it was interesting to see, I suppose, in these times, no more that, you know, we're doing our Zoom interviews, to see that the Holstein Verband are now doing mare assessments by video, that they can do them remotely.
Michael, these are some of my pet subjects. I sat and got chastised when I tried to suggest this, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. Okay, I can't do that. And now, you know, it's being done because it's been forced on by the pandemic where you just can't get to it. But I used to always say, look, there's nothing that a video can't see, you know, that your eyes can see.
So, yeah, because it's quite descriptive in terms of what you have to do. I was reading up on it, and it's fairly, what do you call it, descriptive or prescriptive, where they've asked you what exactly they want to do, what they want to see, you know, trot, canter, and freedom. It's all there. It's all there.
And I mean, you like me, you get on YouTube and you watch all these videos and you can see horses jumping the Olympics and world championships. And well, I'm pretty sure at the end of the day, you have a good idea of how those horses jumped around. But oh my goodness, we can't evaluate a mare for breeding by that medium. Are you kidding me? It can all be seen. And now it's going that way. Where it was really important to us in America is we've got this vast landmass.
Yes.
And very often it wasn't possible to get a judge. Well, you were asking somebody to drive their horse 5-6 hours across country to be evaluated. And very often the people wouldn't do that. Now what happens is we would lose that mare. Because other stud books have always been very happy to grab, you know, good Holsteiner mares.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that, I mean, that you think about what the Holsteiner Verband is doing now. And my argument always used to be, and it's sort of off the record, I don't mind saying it though, is Holstein was strengthening other stud books with its great genetics. And it was not finding a way to take those genetics back in, made every excuse to not take the horse. And I used to say, this makes no sense. You're losing World Breeding Federation points. This horse on paper is a Holstein, yet it's got a different registration. It's in a different verband, and it's giving points elsewhere. Need to find a way to get those genetics back and to get those good horses in. And so that's really where we're at now, and I think it's a very, very positive. Anybody listen to this, the Holsteiners, I think, have set themselves up beautifully to be able to be unified fairly worldwide as a breed association, provided you meet their fairly stringent yet quite open-minded breeding rules. You know, they've done a good job with it now.
The question that I finish each interview with is, what advice would you offer to a young person or someone at the start of their breeding program? But I'm also going to throw an extra element into it, because you're the first person that I'm interviewing who's situated in the US. So the second element to that is, what advice would you offer specifically to a breeder based in the USA as well? So if we can go two parts with this, one is the advice to a young person or at the start of their breeding program. But then I'm wondering if you have any specific advice for your fellow breeders in the US.
Okay. I would say if somebody is interested in breeding, they sometimes get into it by default. They have a horse that gets injured and they can't do anything with this mare, and they think, well, I'm going to get into breeding. Or people get into breeding because they really think, wow, I want to breed. But I would encourage them is to stop for a moment and think about what you're about to embark on and become obsessed, and I'm going to talk about jumping, with producing a good quality jumper. Really think about it. What does it take to produce a good quality jumper? Just don't go and breed just for the sake of breeding. You need to look at what you that you, you have something that you're aiming at, and set a thought in your mind and an image in your mind, because I sometimes have people come to me and they've got a particular mare and then they've seen some stand and they want to breed, and I think, oh my goodness, that's not going to work. You're going to breed backwards. You might end up with a 18-2 hand monster here. You've got to look that this horse is ultimately, horses that we breed are to go to sport. So are you going to be able to produce one that's able to do that? So I think the second thing that we spoke about earlier is that rideability is key. You know, if your mare isn't rideable and your mare wasn't sound and your mare's got two crooked front legs and you don't even know where her pedigree is from, you might not want to breed her. Okay? This is not the way to go. So your mare needs to be good enough. If you're going to breed, be critical. I always tell people when they bring a horse to me to look at and they want to get my opinion, I say, don't ask for my opinion if you don't want my opinion. I'm going to tell you exactly what I think. And if she's not good enough to breed, I'm going to tell you. Or if she's good enough to breed, I'm going to tell you all her weaknesses. I'll tell you her strong points and her weaknesses, because I value, that's how I look at my horses. I'm very critical on them. I need to know what, you know, what I'm looking at, what am I not necessarily going to fix because it just doesn't work like that, but what are the strengths and weaknesses so that I can at least bear those in mind. And then when I'm looking at the offspring, did I get it right? So, you know, you're going to produce an animal that's going to be around for 25 years. It's, don't take that lightly. If your mare is not good enough, do not breed her. You have no chance. None. If you've got this off-the-track thoroughbred that could never jump over 3 foot high, and then it broke down when it was 8 years old because of conformational problems, and now you think breeding that horse is a good idea, it's a terrible idea. Don't do it. Because you're creating a living being that's going to be here for 25 years, okay? And it's expensive. And that horse, while you might be able to show me some that have gone on and produced good horses like that, for the most part, it doesn't work like that. If you go and look at breeders that know what's going on, you know, breeding is not just by chance. They've really thought it through very carefully and been very analytical.
And just flipping that for a minute, going back to one of your earlier points, from your study, from your trips to Holstein, from your visits to all the breeders, and from now your own experience in breeding, are there essential characteristics that you feel that a mare should have as a starting point to give yourself the best possible chance of breeding good horses?
Absolutely. Now look, as a Holsteiner breeder, took me a while to understand this, but it's all about the mother line, the stem. In all my horses, I can tell you every mother and father back to 1850. And so there's a great depth to that. And Holstein has tracked these mother lines. And there are certain mother lines that are better producers than others. Let's take the horse Casal by, let's look at Casal as a very, very good example. He's out of mother line 890. Casal is not a one-off sort of lucky hit. Mm-hmm. Casal is out of a very, very good mother line, quite closely related to Eurocommis Berlin. But there were three mares that produced, three sisters or half-sisters that produced six approved stallions. Last time I looked, there might even be more than that. So not by chance. We had Capone One who jumped at 1.60 here. It's out of a Casal's mother's sister. So what I'm saying is that when you look at a stallion like that, that not only jumped at the top of the sport, but it's also been an incredible producer because he's from a great mother line. And it took me years to understand that. I'll give you another example of it that I found very, very interesting early on. Sitting at the stallion approvals, two stallions are there. Okay, both jump well. One, and then a breeder would turn to me and say to me, okay, which one of the breeders going to use? oh, I don't know, they'll use that one. They said, no, breeders won't use that one. They're going to use the other one. I said, but it didn't jump as well. I said, yes, but it jumped good enough, and it's from a brilliant mother line. That other one is from a mother line that hasn't produced anything. The breeders won't use it. Of course, there'd be a few that would. I never understood that in the beginning. Now I absolutely get it. That's why when you look at Casal has produced so well, it's his mother line. It's his mother line, that's why.
I think my only memory of experiencing that kind of a scenario at an approval was one year at the KWPN Stallion Show, where I think there was a horse jumped nice or okay, but I have a feeling that he wasn't selected because there was nothing in the family.
Yeah.
And I haven't come across it anywhere else until you made that. Sorry, I haven't come across it in an inspection capacity, obviously in breeder discussions and things like that, but until you made that point, yeah.
Well, I think we look at a stallion like Cardento, there's absolutely no doubt that he's fourth on the world breeding sire list at the moment, fourth or fifth, but certainly being one of the greatest stallions in the last number of years for breeding top level show jumpers. Well, who's important to us now since we can no longer get his semen? And yeah, there's Cartella. Why? Because it's the same mother, Estelle. Okay. Does he have a chance of producing well? Oh, absolutely. And breeders are going to be watching that. Not only did he jump, not only does he jump at the top of the sport and the another Olympian. I mean, that's amazing. You've got a mother that's been able to do that. The mother. Look, Michael, if you breed well, you go out and you say, well, but I don't have a good mare. Okay, well, there's two ways you can go about this if you don't have a ton of money. Go and find a foal, filly foal from a very, very good mother line, either here or in Germany. Okay, you need to like the filly. She needs to be well conformed, but that's one way to start. Or another way is buy an embryo out of a very, very good mare. The reason, if you breed a bad horse, it's never worth more than a few thousand dollars. That's what it's worth the day it's born, and it never goes up. It's useless. I mean, you see them at some local shows. Like, well, with all due respect, that horse isn't very talented. I mean, we have to call a spade. It's not. Never going to be worth more. It's never going to go to any high level. It just doesn't have the athletic ability. Yet the other one, if it's bred, if you've got a very good embryo from a very good mother and so on, and you have now some good fortune, you bring it on, it can have a lot more value. So, yes, you're investing a little bit more, but you certainly have a much bigger upside. And it's the right way to do it. Don't bring this animal into this world unless you have a real plan for it. Okay? And the other thing, I think... if people go into breeding, I'll see this. They'll have a mare, they'll ask me about it and ask them the bloodlines, and they have no clue. Okay. And then they get the bloodlines and show me it doesn't mean anything to them. And I think if you're going to really do it, go ahead and get some knowledge. Go, if you're going to want to embark on this, go and speak to people. There are a lot of people out there that are interested in there, and go out and study it. Certainly all of us started by not knowing anything, and with time we get to know. But if you don't know anything, be realistic about it. I don't know anything. Go ahead and learn about it. And if you're really interested, go over to Holstein and look at a few hundred foals. And by the end of a week of doing that, you'll have some good idea between the good foals and the bad foals, and the ones that get a 9-9, well conformed, good movement, and the one that gets a 5-5. I can easily pick those up. Okay. You go ahead and look at the mares. One thing about when you look at the foals is you get to see the mares very often with the foals. So you get to see what type with a stallion, okay, on this type of mare can produce this. It doesn't always work that way, but it gives you a starting point. And then go to stallion approvals and start to see, okay, this is what young horses look like. Then you start seeing this to your stallion. And then that raises your game. You think, these are magnificent animals. That's what I'm trying to produce. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now I'm trying to produce a Ferrari here. I'm trying to produce something. It opens your mind, and you'll spend, you'll have a little pause before you do it so that you can do it right. It's possible to do it right. But people shouldn't be flippant about this. It's you know, otherwise they just throw stuff together that doesn't make sense in the hope that it's going to work. But really, top horses haven't been born; they've been bred. It's not by chance. And I'm sure you agree with that as a breeder.
Isn't that? I do indeed.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. Has to be. So, yeah, I mean, that would be my comments on somebody who wants to get into this, is to just have a pause before you start so that you really think through it.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?